We are live there, Mr. Gibbs. How are you today?
I am very well, and I'm finally, I think, over that horrible cough I had.
Very nice. Well, I'm happy to hear that. Welcome, everybody, to the
Fresh Air in Oregon did it for me.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Yeah. Welcome, everybody.
I said the fresh air in Oregon did it for me. I have to take a knife and fork to my ear here.
Okay. Well, let me welcome everybody to the Untold History Channel. I forgot to do that. And it's the Constitution Tuesday, so apologize. I just jumped right into saying hello, Mr. Gibbs. So anyway, I'm glad you had the fresh Oregon air to help you.
Yeah, right on the coast, you can see all the stars at night. Good stuff.
I invited Mr. Warhamster to come. I don't know if he's going to come or not. I didn't talk to him, but I just sent him an email. And so if he joins us, awesome. If he doesn't, no big deal. But I did let him know that he was invited to come if he wanted to.
I was on the horn with him last night, and we're working on some future plans. In the next few months, I'm going to start moving everything online and really putting on effort. Looks like my KMET show will transfer from that AM radio show station in Beaumont to my own platform. So the only difference will be who's hosting it. Everything else should remain pretty much the same. So, and the call-in number will probably change.
Okay. I actually have a friend who is looking to get off of some other stuff, and I mentioned... I didn't mention any names about what he was doing or anything, but I did mention that I knew somebody who was working on something that he might be interested in. So I need to actually have a conversation with Mr. Hamster. But anyway, that said, how are you? How is everybody today? Let's see. I need to get over to my I don't even have the thing up. So,
well, we have Minnesota Patriot, Melvin, Yarn Addict, YF12C, Safira. So those are the folks speaking or typing, should I say, in the chat. Yep. Of course, we have a lot more people watching, and the number is growing every second. And appreciate all of you. Keep coming every week and tell friends about it. Let's grow this.
Yeah, I had a very interesting day yesterday.
Interesting day yesterday? Did it have anything to do with cats?
No, it did not have anything to do with cats. It had to do with...
It's something relatively new then.
Yeah. I had a live stream with it was going to be six me and five other veterans, and let's just suffice it to say that it went off the rails very fast. I was blindsided by I was just blindsided, and it I didn't want what happened to happen, but it did, and it was really little. It happened so dang fast.
It wasn't a good kind of blindsiding.
No, it wasn't a very good blindsiding, and I did the very best that I could to handle it to as professionally as I could. And I actually got a few people complimented me on the way that I handled it, and I got a few people who didn't like the way it got handled because they just thought I should have done something more, and that there was nothing that I could have done. But anyway, all is well. It's like the ramifications of that are still, I'm surprised that show hasn't exploded, in terms of like views. It's just, but anyway, I digress.
Well, every show has its pluses and minuses. The plus here is we get to talk about the Constitution. The minus is we have a Dodger fan in the studio, but you wrestle with these things.
The Dodger fan, at least I know what a winning team looks like.
Yeah.
Well. So, Yeah.
Well, you got to use a Yankee type of pocketbook in order to do it, but okay.
No, that's not totally true.
Okay.
That's not totally true. But, you know, hey, it does help that there's a lot of money there. That definitely helps.
All right. But so anyways, we have Evil Empire East, the Yankees, Evil Empire West, the Dodgers. See, the two evil empires.
I'm okay with that.
All right. So ready to get rolling on
let's do it.
The Evil Empire of the North?
Yes. Mr. Lincoln himself, who I am not a fan of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I was teaching a class in Vista a couple weeks ago, and one of the persons who regularly Skypes into the show, he lives in Riverside, and he tries to catch everything I do. He actually donates like $25 a month. He'll help, you know, fund what I do and all that. And I finished my history book, which I think I told you guys last week, and it is on sale.
Yeah, I need to get one. I need to get a copy and then have you sign it before you go north.
Yeah, but anyway, a Promise of Truth, Self-Evident, Part 1, Early American History. And he says, so what did you say about Lincoln in the book? He says, oh, that's Part 2. Didn't get there yet, but I bet you can guess what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And he says, I have a feeling it won't be real favorable. And I said, well, you're barking up the right tree, buddy. Exactly. And that kind of ties to what we're talking about today. So we've worked our way through most of the Constitution, and we've worked our way out of the 18th century into the 19th century. And now we're past the middle of the 19th century into a period that really jarred America into a bad direction. Now, that said, there were already crossroads, key moments in our history before that that tilted us towards oligarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bank of the United States, it would be one of them. John Marshall's court, especially Marbury versus Madison and the Judicial Review creation of, you know, did. 8 or 9 of John Marshall's rulings during his career strengthened the idea of federal supremacy, regardless of authorities in the Constitution. There's a number of them, but the war between the states, that was the one that really grabbed America by the neck and threw us down to the mat and put an elbow into our neck. I mean, it that was the moment that really shifted the whole fight completely.
Who was the judge who said that he didn't want to take the position because there wasn't enough power?
Oh, that was John Jay.
John Jay. Okay.
Yeah, he was the first Chief Justice.
Right.
He was the first Chief Justice. He was offered to be, you know, for the fourth opening and rejected it. And then John Marshall wound up with it. And there's a whole story behind that. And we're on Article 3. That's something we could talk about again in the future. But anyway, now National Treasure. Ever watch that movie, Nicolas Cage?
I did.
Right? There's two of them. National Treasure, the first one, and the second one. So the second one. Okay. In the second one, there is a moment while they're in the house of Gates's dad, which is played by Voight. And and Nicolas Cage's character says something interesting, and I about dropped my popcorn in the theater because it was essentially right. And then, like most things in Hollywood, they get it right for just a moment and then screw it up. But what he said right originally was he's talking about the war between the states. Of course, he says the Civil War. It wasn't a civil war. I'll get into that.
Nope.
And so he says, well, you know, the Civil War, before then it was the United States are. And afterwards, it became the United States is correct. Mm-hmm. I was shocked.
And a lot of people, a lot of people attribute that to the the corporation thing.
Well, that was the beginning of the shift, and what it's basically saying is we went from a union of states that are voluntarily in the union with a limited central government to a firm union where the states don't have a choice. They can't secede. They're in it, and the national government is in charge of everything. That's a tighter, firmer, can't escape kind of union. And then after I'm starting to smile, then Ben Gates, Nicolas Cage's character, then says something that then just destroyed my smile. And he says, "So it really wasn't until then that we were truly united as a nation." And then that popcorn that I dropped, well, what I've been eating now was also on the ground. So, and that's the way they look at it. And when I say they, I'm talking about anybody to the left of the Constitution, which is probably about 95% of people in office. What happened was we have this idea here that localism, you, your local government, and states can't be trusted to do the right thing. You'll foul it up, but don't worry. Your will, what's good for the common good, what's good for the union. Well, those elites at the federal level, they're able to interpret what's best for the country and apply it properly, you know, for your peace and safety, of course. That's basically what the idea is. And of course, we've seen this pop up and vanish throughout history over and over and over. It's called tyranny, for those of you who are been living under a rock. And that's what really began full throttle. It was the tendrils of it were already reaching into government. The people who believed that garbage were already walking the halls of Congress. But the lurch of the country, almost almost in a codified manner, to head towards national status, not a federal government, not a limited government, but a supreme power at the top. That's what really kind of happened during the war between the states. And what happened was, and it's interesting to look back in history, because at the time, while the Democrat Party favored slavery, they also knew it was coming to an end. Their problem, the secession, wasn't because of slavery. It was how they were being treated regarding the issue and how they were, the Constitution was being violated and how they were being dictated to by the federal government regarding that issue. If they're going to violate the Constitution with us on this issue, what else are they going to violate the Constitution on? Kind of attitude, okay? And so even though the Democrat Party and the Southerners at the time were pro-slavery, or at least they were trying to hang on to it as long as they could before it killed itself from within, which they saw coming. They knew it was going to happen. Matter of fact, I have a book. You know what? I packed it away already to Oregon. It's called The South Was Right.
I have Kennedy that book. Brothers.
Yeah, it's a very good book. And in it, there is a they give you the transcript, essentially, of a conversation between Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. They know that slavery's dying.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is we don't want to be treated by force by a federal government, because they were, and this is the point I was going to get to, the Democrats were the small government, state sovereignty, states' rights party. The Republican Party, which was created in 1854, first of all, they say it was created for the purpose of outlawing slavery. No, it was created for the purpose of having a party that opposed the Democrat Party, and the Whig Party wasn't doing it anymore because of internal infighting. Also, Lincoln didn't run to abolish slavery. He ran to contain it, to keep it in the South. And in fact, he loved the idea of sending free blacks or emancipated blacks to Liberia in Africa, which was a colony set up by the United States for that purpose. Britain had done it with a colony called Sierra Leone. And actually, Sierra Leone, after failing at first, started to actually do quite well for a while. Now it's a crap hole, but for a while there, it was managing quite well.
The funny thing is that the capital of Liberia is Monrovia.
Monrovia, after James Monroe. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at flag... If you look at the flag of Liberia,
red, white, and blue,
it is, it's only got a single star, but it is basically it's almost it's almost the American flag, but with a single star.
Right. Yeah, and their currency is called the dollar, and oh, we go on and on and on. All right, mm-hmm. So the Republicans believed that they were but at this point, they were largely Hamiltonians. They were people who believed in a firm union, no escape, can't secede, how dare you, the federal government's in charge. And so the radical Republicans, as some historians will call them early on, were quite big government. So in that sense, the parties has flipped. Of course, the Democrats will tell you they flipped on racism, which isn't true. But the parties did flip when it came to, you know, big government versus limited government beliefs. Now, Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer out of Illinois. He was born in Kentucky, but went to law school in Illinois, and he went to law school at the very tail end of the John Marshall regime in the as Chief Justice in the Supreme Court. So the law schools were really following the ideas that John Marshall pushed over the last 30 plus years, like 35 years at that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of like today's law schools, you know, they push judicial review. They push a lot of Marshall stuff too, but they also push a lot of other things. Because they don't care what the law says, even though if you look at the statuette of justice, you know, liberty or justice, I'm sorry, is blind. Only the law matters. Right. Unfortunately, they don't follow that. And neither did the legal system during the mid 1800s. They were really following John Marshall's nationalist push, this push for a stronger central system, federal supremacy, so on and so forth. And so that's what Abraham Lincoln went to school during. So coming out of law school and starting his practice as a lawyer, he in many ways was a product of his education. So I'm not letting him off the hook per se, but it was definitely a heavy influence regarding how he thought and what he believed. The Jeffersonian model of the United States is a limited government. The powers must be enumerated in the United States Constitution, and it's a voluntary union. States can secede, according to the 10th Amendment. But the Marshall, the Hamiltonian view of America, firm republic, national government, federal supremacy regardless of authority, and it's a hierarchy. It's a ranking system. You know, the counties supersede the states, and the state supersedes the county, and the federal government supersedes the state on everything is the attitude. Well, not necessarily. It really depends on the authorities. Now we had mentioned Monroe earlier, and Monroe's an interesting sort. And this, and actually Tackleberry kind of brought this up, in the chat room. So let's kind of capitalize on a little bit. The founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution and they put in there that the Atlantic slave trade would be over January 1st, 1808. And it was when 1808 rolled around. And they were creating the system of liberty and all of that. And abolition was beginning to bubble up in the North. The founding fathers believed that slavery would be gone within their lifetime. But it stuck around. Part of the reason it stuck around was because this idea, which began with the three-fifths clause, but it then almost became, canonized in policy, was that neither pro-slave or anti-slave could dominate the other in Congress. So they did what they could to kind of keep it even. By the time Monroe came along, there was 11 free states and 11 slave states. So in the Senate, it was, when it came to slavery as an issue, tied. Missouri was considering joining the country. Missouri would come in as a slave state. They already had slaves in that territory. Maine, which was a territory of Massachusetts, wanted to be its own state. So Missouri became into the Union as a slave state. Maine came as a free state. And with it was an act that was written, which was unconstitutional. It's none of the federal government's business. See, all these problems in history is because the federal government stuck its nose into it. But anyway, federal government then passes the Missouri Compromise, which dictates there on out. That's the process. That's the policy. That anything comes in south of the southern border of Missouri would come in as a slave state. Anything that comes in north of the Missouri southern line would come in as a free state. And the politicians thought they did a good thing there. There was two problems with it. Number one, it's none of the federal government's business to dictate if a state is slave or free. And two, it really kind of screwed up the natural progression of the way things were going to go. I've mentioned this before, I don't talk about it a lot because I don't spend a lot of time on it, but I want you guys to understand this so that we can set the stage a little bit here. Farming, you rotate your fields, rotate the crops, that kind of stuff, right? You when you're in farming and you use a field long enough, if you don't, recharge it with more nutrients and all that, eventually that property becomes pretty much useless. You can't grow on it anymore. You got to leave it alone for a long time to allow it to kind of come back to. So slavery, since it was attached to agricultural, farming, cotton, tobacco, things like that, the South, that means the states that used slavery were always seeking new fertile ground. Now, if you look at the United States, south of the southern line of Missouri, it's not fertile ground. It's Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona. Not exactly known for being fertile farming soil.
No.
It's more desert and dust than anything. There are areas that you can farm and you can turn that soil into a good thing. But at the time, they didn't have the same kind of technology we have or the same understanding of certain things. So the slave states running out of fertile land and needing to expand to keep the agricultural requirements going when it comes to how much product they're putting out, needing more fertile land, realize that. And what they really want is Kansas and Nebraska. Kansas and Nebraska, however, is north of that southern line of Missouri. Now, that is how the Missouri Compromise really led us partly towards this war. Because what it did is the federal government, number one, forced the numbers to remain even in Congress. If left alone, more free states would have come in, and legislatively, the slave states would have been outnumbered, and they were economically, slavery was dying anyway. It was a dying industry. It was cheaper to hire someone than to own them, especially now that because of inventions, you didn't need as many people in the field as much as you needed people in the factories.
Right. When did the Yucatan seek?
That was 1840s, 50s. I don't remember the exact. Well, you know what? See, I can do something here, which is kind of nice now. You'll like this.
I forgot when the Yucatan, there was an area on the Yucatan Peninsula that they actually wanted to be.
They actually applied for statehood. Mm-hmm. So let's pull out my history book and take a look real quick. So I'll go to the index here.
Republic of Yucatan, in late 1845, the Mexican Congress revoked the conventions of December 1843 and the Assembly of Yucatan.
So I thought it was 1840s or 50s, yeah.
So it's what it looks like here.
What he's talking about is Yucatan Peninsula was under siege by the Mayan Indians, which had been set on them by Santa Anna. And the only reason why he used the Mayan Indians is because he didn't have enough forces to go after them at that point. Darn it, I went to the wrong page here. I'm not going to get into it.
The Republic of Yucatan usually refers to the Second Republic, 1841 to 1848. The Republic of Yucatan was governed by the
Constitution. Yep, kept leaving Spain, Mexico. It had a history of that. Yeah. And what was happening was Santa Anna, because he hated the 1824 Constitution of Mexico. So he was going after everybody who supported that constitution and was against him. And the Yucatan, they were seeking protection from Santa Anna and the Mayan Indians who had been set against them. And they were calling out to America to give them military aid. And America's like, why? You're not a state. You're not a U.S. holding. We don't want to get into it with Santa Anna at this point. And so the name's funny. O'Reilly is like the last name of the Mexican Yucatan guy who led the delegation to Washington, D.C. It's kind of funny. He's got this first and middle, you know, Spanish name, but his last name is like O'Reilly. But anyway, and he and his delegation goes to Washington, D.C. requesting statehood. They figure if they got statehood, then they would get the military protection. There were actually political cartoons at the time that jokingly called the Gulf of Mexico the Lake of America, because we also had like our grip kind of in Cuba and a few other, you know, parts around, you know. So it was a big deal. Part of the reason that the Yucatan, didn't get approved for statehood was because they're south of that southern line of Missouri Compromise.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and that was kind of where I was going.
Which was in 1823. Yeah. So that was part of the reason. Yeah. Missouri Compromise was very unconstitutional. The federal government couldn't dictate to a state. So now what happened, though, an unintended consequence, is knowing that the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional, knowing that the South was looking for fertile land, what they decided to do when it came to Kansas and Nebraska is they passed the Kansas and Nebraska Act, which basically said, okay, fine, it's up to Kansas and Nebraska to decide if they're going to be a slave state or a free state, which is the right thing to do. But what it triggered was this giant rush from Missouri and from the South and from northern states into Kansas to try to get the majority number. So people who are pro-slave, people pro, you know, the free soilers, as they called them, are all rushing to Kansas to try to get the numbers to turn that state either free or slave, depending on who you were. And it got violent. So Bloody Kansas or Bleeding Kansas are a couple of terms used for that region at the time. So ultimately Kansas came in as a free state, but anyway, that it was like a war. I mean, it was being fought, and a lot of people believe it was a precursor to what we would see with war between the states. Now, when it came to the war between the states, while slavery is an ingredient, it was really about how the southern states were being treated by the federal government. Once again, going back to what I said earlier, if they're going to be unconstitutional against us about these things when it comes to slavery, how else is the federal government going to treat us unconstitutionally? The Southern Democrats did believe in states' rights, and they were right on that part of it. And so when Abraham Lincoln won the election, and while he didn't say he was going to abolish slavery, he basically said he wanted to hold together the Union and not mess with slavery. But they knew that might be next. They claimed that's what was on the docket someday. And also, they didn't trust the Republican Party, because the Republican Party's attitude was, we're going to keep the Union together by force if we have to, attitude. So right after Lincoln became president, South Carolina was gone, first one. After it was all over, most of them during the time period between the election and the inauguration of Lincoln, a handful of them afterwards, I think Arkansas and Texas and I want to say Mississippi and I think Louisiana, I think those are the ones that happened afterwards. The rest of them were kind of before the inauguration of Lincoln. They left. Then, now you've got these states that have seceded. They have left the Constitution. They are no longer under the Constitution. They have left the contract because they believed it was breached. They are, and then they come together as their own country. Confederate States of America. But what happens to the federal properties in that region? For example, imagine, so that you understand what I mean here, imagine, if you will, whatever state you're from, here in California, there's a lot of them, the military bases that belong to the federal government. Here it's 32nd Street, North Island, big Navy bases, Camp Pendleton, Marine Corps, these huge bases that are here. You know, you might say, you know, Nellis Air Force Base, you know, in Nevada. You know, just imagine that federal property, that big base that's in your state. Let's say, hypothetically, your state decided to secede. Does it get to keep that federal property, or does that federal property still belong to the federal government? Well, guess what? The states can say, that's ours. The federal government can say, no, that's our base. That is our property. You've got a problem now, don't you? There is a conflict over who owns and should control that property. That's what happened in South Carolina, Fort Sumter. Fort Sumter, Army base. Army bases are forts. Marine bases are camps. Navy bases are stations, typically. And then Air Force has bases. But anyway, so Fort Sumter, this Army facility, federal property. South Carolina says, hey, it's ours. No, federal government says that's our fort. And the, I can't remember if he was a general or a colonel. I think he was a colonel, guy who was running the fort. He was a hardcore dude. They'll have to carry me out of here in a stretcher kind of attitude.
Who, Anderson?
Whoever was in charge of Sumter at the time.
Major Anderson.
Was it Major Anderson? No. Was it?
Yeah, Major Anderson. Major Anderson was the guy who was in charge of the fort. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then it was Major Anderson. And he had a hardcore attitude. He wasn't going to leave.
When he was teaching at the academy at West Point, his most astute student was Beauregard, and Beauregard was the guy who was on the other side, firing the artillery at the fort.
Oh, that's funny. All right, very good. So anyway, so Aunt Major Anderson, if that's the person, I was trying to remember the name. I couldn't remember the name. So he's like, I'm not leaving. And the federal government's saying this is our base. And so what do we do here? And the Confederates will say, what's our base? It's our land. We're going to take it. And they did. They rushed it. And they waited until that base was low on supplies. And then, you know, and there was a debate over whether or not the North could bring in supplies for them. And there was all kinds of stuff that happened before it. But eventually the Confederates rushed it, and that's what started the war. Now, let me say a couple more things before we start reading the constitutional amendments. So you'll hear me say often that the war between the states, and I don't typically call it a civil war because it wasn't. A civil war is when two sides are fighting over a hole. But the Confederate states had left the whole. So they weren't fighting over the whole. They were fighting over their right to be apart from the whole. So it wasn't a civil war. It was a war between the states, a war between the Union states and the Confederate States of America. And so I tell people this war was not about slavery. And I usually get laughed at or attacked for that. Unless someone really wants to listen. If it was about slavery, if slavery was the primary factor, it was an ingredient, but it was not the primary factor. If that was the primary factor, then Washington, D.C. would have abolished slavery by then. Washington, D.C., while they did abolish the buying and selling of slaves in Washington, D.C., slavery itself wasn't abolished in Washington, D.C. till 1862, a year after the war started. Also understand there were a number of states who were slave states that did not secede. They did not believe that secession was the right thing to do, and they remained in the Union. And the Union did not demand that they get rid of slavery. Missouri, Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland. And while most of your maps won't show New Jersey also had about a dozen and a half slaves in the state.
Well, New Jersey was the last state to...
January 23rd, 1866 is when they finally got rid of slavery, the last state to do it.
Yep.
And all 16 slaves were freed at that point. But anyway, so... And then when Virginia seceded, a bunch of counties, Virginia said, hey, we disagree with secession. It was like 42 counties, something like that. They then reapplied to the Union as West Virginia, a slave state. And they were accepted into the Union as a slave state.
Right.
So if the war was about slavery, if the slavery was the primary ingredient and the main reason for it to happen, how was it then that Washington, D.C. did not abolish slavery until a year after the war started? And there were a number of slave states that remained in the Union when the war started, and West Virginia was accepted into the Union after the war started as a slave state. So understand that circumstantial evidence right there tells you slave, while maybe a factor, was not the primary factor. The primary factor was the Constitution. The primary factor was, is the federal government treating the southern states properly according to the law of the land? They believed it was being violated, so they seceded. Then the response from the north was, secession is illegal. This is a firm union. It's not a voluntary union, even though the founders explained it was a voluntary union. That is what it was really about. Getting back to, and someone commented about this in the chat room earlier. When Abraham Lincoln was campaigning, he basically said that his campaign, his push to be president, was all about preserving the Union, not interfering with slavery. He'd like to contain slavery, he said in the Lincoln-Douglas debates when he ran for Senate, which Douglas wound up winning that, by the way, that election. But in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which are fantastic, I encourage you to read them. Lincoln is very clear. He didn't want to abolish slavery for a couple of reasons. One, because he just didn't want to mess with it. Two, because the people in the North... See, everybody treats the North like they're just a bunch of wonderful, non-racist, loving people. Well, see, the people in the North were afraid that if the slaves were freed, they would move northward looking for work. And they didn't want them in their neighborhoods or taking their jobs.
Nope.
So don't let the Northerners off the hook so quickly.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing that really just absolutely just boils my blood. People have this misconception that the northern states were these altruistic, good, you know, we want to abolish slavery. You know, they were the furthest thing from abolitionist. In fact, when the Emancipation Proclamation was put out, a tenth of the army quit. They're like, we ain't fighting for slaves. That's not why we signed up. We signed up to save the Union, not to free slaves. And
well, that was the reason for the Emancipation Proclamation, was to make it about slavery.
Right, I understand that.
Yeah,
but you're right.
About a tenth of the military left, but so did Europe.
Right,
Europe had been involving themselves in helping the South. They had been helping fund them, giving them equipment. Britain had been building ships for them. And they also had these runners, I'm trying to remember the name of them, something runners that the British were using, and what that was like, these supply runners, and what they would do, because the North had pretty much bottled up all of the southern coast, all the way down and around to it. Because you know, the South didn't have a navy, the North did. But the British had these fast quick, easy to maneuver ships that would sneak in there, these runners, and they would bring in supplies and stuff like that. So, and so how do you get the British to stop doing that? How do you get the French and the Germans and a few others to stop sending in help? Well, see, slavery had already been abolished in the rest in Europe, not necessarily in all of the European colonies, but in Europe in general. And so when the Emancipation Proclamation was delivered by Lincoln, it wasn't about freeing slaves. It didn't free any slaves. But it was a political move to make the war about slavery. It hadn't been about slavery at that point. It had been about holding together the Union. Emancipation Proclamation shifted the reason for the war to slavery. Now you've got the people in Europe complaining to their governments. You're sending help to support slavery? The people went against their governments, and their governments then pulled out of any assistance for the Confederacy. It was a political move to get Europe out of the war. That's what the Emancipation Proclamation was all about.
Correct.
So now that we've laid all that groundwork, I want to point out one more thing. Prior to the 13th Amendment, you will not find the word slave or slavery in the Constitution. The framers of the Constitution and the early generations knew that slavery was evil. They hated it. Granted, only two of the first 12 presidents never owned slaves, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. All the others owned slaves, even if it was a few. That said, all of them, except for Andrew Jackson and on, but before Andrew Jackson, from Adams down to Washington, all of them were abolitionists. All of them hated slavery. All of them believed that slavery needed to be gone. And they expected it to be gone within their lifetime. Now you've got a political situation where things have shifted. Slavery, secession, all of this. So a war winds up being fought. And the leader of the war is referred to by some historians as the benevolent dictator.
Mm-hmm.
They admit that what Abraham Lincoln did during the war and what the radical Republicans did during the war and after the war in Reconstruction was unconstitutional and, well, dictatorial. From the suspension of habeas corpus in Maryland to a long list of other things, Lincoln stomped all over the Constitution. Now, for those of you who absolutely love Abraham Lincoln, have always held him up on this high pedestal, let me say this to you. That's what they wanted you to do. That's why he's on the one, that's why he's on the penny. That's why he's on, what, the $5 bill. That's why he's elevated as being the one of the greatest presidents of all time. Because, see, the left will always elevate those who agree with them when it comes to tyranny, oligarchy, national. The greatest presidents in your history books will be, you'll be told they were weak presidents. The ones that believed in tyranny, they're held up in high regard. Does that mean that everything Lincoln did was bad, or he was just an absolutely evil person all the way across the board? I don't know. I didn't know the man personally, but I believe that for the most part, he thought, not an excuse, but he thought he was doing the right thing. He thought he was doing the benevolent thing. He thought he was doing the Christian thing. And I think he believed himself to be a Christian. But nearly every single move he made was against the Constitution and was tyrannical during that war.
Absolutely. You know, I want to show something here.
Okay.
Oh, damn it. Jesus.
And Yarn Addict, very good point. Yarn Addict, they freed the black slaves, then turned around and enslaved all of us. You got it. The plantation moved from the plantation owner to the federal government. The plantation still exists. The master, through programs, will give you your bread and your housing. All you have to do is just give your full tribute and honor and patriotism. I'm sorry, it's not patriotic, but towards the government. They call it patriotic. Anyway,
this is a picture of Abraham Lincoln sitting on his throne. And if you look on the edge here, right here, these things right here, go back here. This stuff right here, those mm-hmm. are fascies, and those are symbols of fascism, and that is what they hold up bundling. To honor, huh?
Yeah, bundling. That's what that is.
Yeah,
because the fascies. For those of you, bring it up again for people to see.
Okay, I'm gonna present this, and I'll be right back. I've got it. I am bleeding profusely. So,
all right. So, these fascies here, what they represent is called bundling. Bundling is the basic foundational idea of fascism. Fascism, it's funny because Hitler claimed that fascism was the opposite of communism, and that's part of the reason why the left puts fascism on the far right. If Hitler says it's the opposite of communism, then it must be on the opposite end of the spectrum. No, it's just a different way to do the same thing. In communism, in order to control the means of production, the government owns it all. In fascism, in order to control the means of production, production is bundled. And that means that it's heavily regulated, tightly woven together and controlled. So while the government doesn't control it, it is bundled. So what you're looking at there is the bundling, which is a sign of fascism, the bundling of regulations. Now, think about what I just said. Control the means of production through heavy regulation. Does that sound familiar? We keep calling our Democrat foes and our Republican foes who ally with the Democrats socialists and communists and Marxists. And in a sense, we're right, but their means of achieving it is actually very fascist. Heavy regulation.
Yes.
What fascism does is because socialism, communism, what it does is it disallows possession, ownership, private industry, it disallows all that. Government owns anything, and you basically work for the government. So fascism gives the illusion that the private sector still exists, the illusion that you still own things, but they control it through heavy regulations. Well, what do you think they're doing today? And thanks, Yarn Addict, Uniparty. As I like to tell people, you know what the difference between the Democrats and Republicans are? I like a handful of the Republicans. That's about
well, you know, I've said many times that it's the, you know, everybody wants to say how evil the Democrats are. You know, you look at people like,
and they are,
like Clinton and Obama and FDR and LBJ. You know, all those people, and they're they are bad. But I would argue that the Republicans who come there and pretend to be conservative while essentially being wolves in sheep's clothing, I would argue that they are actually more dangerous than the Democrats.
Well, the Republican platform, I agree with. A mm-hmm. number of the Republicans, I agree with. The problem with the Republicans, though, if they've thrown in the towel, they decide, okay, well, big government, so there's nothing we can do about it. But don't worry, we can run big government in a conservative manner. That's an impossibility. That is a paradox. No, you can't. Admit it. You're feeding from the same trough. You want the big government. You're getting rich and getting power off the same thing. Just admit it.
If the powers that be really wanted to have change the way, or if they really wanted to win, what they screwed up when they let Obama be president. What they should have done is they should have let McCain be president. Because had McCain had been president, you would have had a whole host of conservatives just laying down, and they could have done whatever they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So when Obama became president, it woke the right up. And had McCain become president, the right would have been asleep. And, you know, the right is the those on the right are, you know, the Democrats already had all of the, and they still had the Senate and the House and all that other. So, I mean, they could have done a whole bunch of stuff.
What do you say, the right? To the right of what?
I meant the left, excuse me. The left. Oh, had,
no, you said, the, no, they you're right the when you they talk had, about the right. But when you were talking about the right and how Obama woke up the right is right of what? They're what? Right of the left, but they are not on the right. They're right. On the left. They are just correct. Not as far left.
Right.
So no, I usually, I'm, you will no, never no, 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 no. use left
I'm talking about the
right.
people. I'm talking about the people.
Mm-hmm.
The right. I'm talking about the conservatives in America woke up with the Tea Party. That was what, you know, when the Tea Party was formed.
No, they're not to the right. Even though everybody thinks they are,
I get that. But my point is that the people who are more conservative than the ones on the left are still more, you know,
sure.
They're not freaking communists.
No, of course not. They're closer to the Constitution than the rest of them. Everything's to the left of the Constitution unless you're a constitutionalist. The only thing to the right of the Constitution are people who want pure democracy and anarchists. And in both cases, they always wind up on the far left with oligarchy.
Correct.
So there really isn't a right. You'll hear me say left. I'll talk about the left all day long. But you'll never, for the most part, hear me say anything about the right, because the right really doesn't exist. Even the right is to the left of the Constitution. They're all leftists. All of them.
Well, what would you classify?
So it's not a matter of leftism. It's a matter of degree of leftism.
Where would you say you and I are?
I'm right there, dead center. I am what I call a classical centrist.
Okay. So are you to the right of the Constitution?
No, I'm right at the Constitution. Constitution is dead center. Constitution okay. is not on the right. Everybody thinks it's to the right because everything's gone so far to the left. Constitution's dead center. It creates a big government and then limits the hell out of it. It's right in the middle.
Okay, you've lost me. On
you've
that
never one. Seen me. You've never seen my presentation of the political spectrum.
Well, is it the same political spectrum that the John Birch Society does in their? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, it's very similar. It was funny because I was teaching that before I saw that video, and I was like, all right, who stole it from who? But I even draw it similarly with the triangle and everything. Constitution is dead center. Democracy and anarchy is to the right of the Constitution. Everything else is to the left. So you're either dead center on the Constitution, or you want pure democracy. Because see, democracy is to the right because it's less government. It's more people. Government doesn't have much say. Everything's voted on. See, that left-right thing is degree of government. What percentage of power does the government have? The Constitution is a distribution of power that enables the government to have some power, the people have some power, the states to have some power, and so on and so forth. Distributed in such a way that nobody has all the power. So it's about in the middle. Government only has about half the power. The people in the states have the other half, and they bounce off of each other's checks and balances. When you start get to the point where there's less government and there's more, actually, maybe I should go this way, more you know, people voice.
Maybe becomes, what we'll do.
That goes to the right. That's less government.
Maybe I think a good exercise would be next week before we start. Let's play that John Burt Society thing, because I think people will be able to see that. It's a lot better when it's visual, and I mm-hmm. think it would be wise to probably do that.
And I also have my own image that I've drawn up of the political spectrum. We could also put that up after they watch a video. And mm-hmm. and what's funny is I drew that image before I ever saw that video. That's mm-hmm. why it's hilarious, because they're almost identical in the basic concepts. I have a saying: when people know the truth, they come to the same conclusions.
That's true.
John Birch Society and I came to the same conclusions. My grandmother was a Bircher, so I've known of the John Birch Society, but I really didn't start paying close attention to them until about 10 years ago or so. And before that, I mean, I knew they were out there, but I really didn't pay attention to what they said or what they did. The reason why John Birch Society and I got to know each other really well is because I started talking about an Article 5 convention, and it turns out they disagree with me. And that became a bone of contention, which actually drew us together, because we would argue about that but agree on everything else, and then, you know, decide we were great allies until it came to that topic.
Yeah, I still don't understand why they disagree.
That's how I got to know the John Birch Society so well.
Yeah, I still don't understand why they don't want the Article 5 convention. But whatever.
All right. Well,
it's time. It's about that time. So
you need to know the reason behind this stuff.
Your internet connection is lagging horribly today. I don't know if you're not able to hear me, but like I'm talking over
video
you.
Games. Well, here's the thing. Partly part of the problem is I have another person in the house that uses a lot more juice than I do because they play online video games. Secondly, I have 500 megs up and down. When I'm up there in Oregon, nobody else is competing with me, and I'm going to be 2 gigs up and down. Okay. So once I'm up there, it'll be good.
Well, I guess
I'm also going to build my office so that I can have better control over my lighting and the whole bit. We've got some good stuff planned.
Good.
I was just, as a matter of fact, last night I was talking to someone about how I want to design that to make sure I got better control over my lighting and how to do that. So yeah,
awesome.
Yeah. So yeah,
well, I'm looking forward to that. So
okay, douglasvgibbs.com. Hit the blog link at douglasvgibbs.com. You can also go to the blog at politicalpistachio.com. I've been writing some pretty interesting articles. One of them is about the word conspiracy, not conspiracy theories, but how they're applying it to Trump and how it makes all of their lawsuits ridiculous. Let me give you a quote real quick from a famous lawyer, and then I'll let Ron shoot us out of here. If a little boy steals candy from a store, it's a misdemeanor. If two little boys talk about stealing that candy but don't do it, it's a conspiracy, and that makes it a felony. Did you notice that all of the charges against Trump is conspiracy to do something? In other words, he talked about it, or at least they interpreted it as him talking about it. All right, it's always good to see you, DouglasVGibbs.com. Buy my new book. And we're going to have our own store up in next week or two. So I'm still looking forward to that too.
No, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. It's interesting that you said that actually gave me some food for thought. So, all right, guys. Well, here in just a few minutes or just a minute or so, actually probably right now it's live. I recorded the show with Mike last night. It is live right now, but when that show is done, I'm going to do kind of it's almost going to be a watch party, because it's going to dovetail with what we talked about yesterday. So I'll be back live at 6 p.m. Or immediately following the show with the pre-recorded show with Mike. So I'll see you guys here in about an hour after I stop my bleeding, and I actually opened up a little bit of can a little food for one of the my cats.
Oh, that's and what it was. So that's what cats do to you.
All of the cats came. All the cats came at once, wanting it, and I had to keep shooing them off. And the one climbed up, and just literally just like tore the crap out of my finger. So I have a big long claw mark right down the center of my pinky, from here to here, all the way down. So yeah, it was very nice. It was very pleasant. So, but dogs don't scratch like that, but they do bite.
Not my boys. Well, they'll bite somebody else. They won't bite me. Keep wanting to give me kisses. You got bad breath, dude. We got to get you teeth brushed. All right. See you guys next week.
All right, guys. Have a great night. We'll see you. I'll see you in about an hour. So,
all right.
have a good night, everybody.